Now on Bloomberg 106.1.
There's a nice cluster of ecosystem within downtown Boston, and I think that that will preserve itself.
The store is not dead. The store is theater. And we're seeing this move to shop locally.
Think about retail. We often think about online shopping, and we're actually starting to see in-store shopping stronger than it has been in quite some time.
All that's happening with venture capital and clean tech and biotech, I'm really proud of the city and proud to be part of it.
This is Bloomberg Bay State Business with Tom Maroney, Joe Shortslave, and Kim Kerrigan on Bloomberg 106.1 Boston Newburyport and 92.9 HD2.
Well, good afternoon. Let the sun shine, right? This is Tom Maroney with Joe Shortslave. Kim Kerrigan is off today. Ann Mostu ably filling in on the news side. And Janet Wolf, of course, she'll be along with a story in this program, all right? Gorgeous summer day. Whether you're helping clients now as devotee of the program, John Jeffries of Pastoral Dover is undoubtedly doing right now, or simply puttering around the house, it's time to stop and listen to Bloomberg Bay State Business. Let's get into this right now. The Boston Women's Workforce Council has been around since 2013. This is a unique public-private partnership between the mayor's office and, you know, employers here in greater Boston who are dedicated to eliminating the gender-racial wage gap. Now, what you should keep in mind as we have this conversation is that this agency recruits employers to sign what is known as the 100% Talent Compact. They recently honored some local companies for their work. And, well, let's bring in the executive director now. Kim Borman has been around several executive positions at big advertising agencies. She even managed her own at one point, Avenue Brand in the South End. And, Kim, always good to talk to you. It's been a while.
It has. Nice to talk to you, too.
All right. Let's start with these recent honorees. You did take note of companies that are working toward these goals. Who are they and what have they done?
So the Innovative Initiative Awards are a way to celebrate our compact signers, who are employers, just like you said, who are dedicated to closing the gender and racial wage gap. They apply for these, and they tell us what they've been doing in the last year. And then against a rubric, we decide who the winners are. This year, we had three great winners. One of them was C-Space, which is a marketing group, a big marketing group that uses data for research. And they actually had a great initiative that was all about diving into their what seemingly were good numbers, but they dove even more into it to look at how they were doing in terms of promoting of diverse candidates. And they realized they had a problem, and so they made some changes to, mm-hmm. to make things better. Another group was Vertex Pharmaceuticals, which is one of our anchor signers, actually. And they were trying to diversify the biotech talent pool, which we all know is a problem. They actually collaborated with a group called Year Up, which does training for young people. And they put together a curriculum that was for kinds of jobs that you wouldn't necessarily need more than a high school education for. And they helped Year Up put it together, got some people into the program, and actually hired close to 90% of them. And then finally, Masco, which you might know because they own a lot of the, they basically run the parking lots and a lot more around the Longwood Medical area. And they had a change in leadership who brought in just an amazing array of different policies almost as soon as we got there. I mean, we changed things like providing access to on-site care, providing free off-site parking at satellite locations for all employees, everything that he could think of to help support women diversify the workforce.
Talking with Kim Borman, she's executive director of the Boston Women's Workforce Council. Kim, talk to us a little bit more about this employer wage gap calculator that obviously these other companies you just highlighted have used. But how does a company use this? Tell us how it works.
So what we are asking employers to do, whether they're compact signers or not, is to look at their numbers. Because if you don't do the math, you can't quite tell if you have a problem or not. So the wage gap calculator, wagegapcalculator.org, is a way for you to put in your internal numbers about sort of really, really asking sort of what is your average compensation for men, compensation for women. And then we ask you to do it by race. And then we also do it by gender and race. And you can compare the numbers that you get, so there, against what our report said. And so you look at your own gap and you compare it to the community snapshot that we do every 2 years with the confidential information from our compact signers.
So, Kim, let's get into this, Lynn. I know it's a question I probably ask you every time we talk, but according to your 2019 data, which I assume is the latest available, women earn 30 cents less on the dollar than their male counterparts. First of all, is that a Boston number or national?
So, first of all, you're actually right. It's 2019, but it was the same in 2021, which is our most recent data.
So 30 cents on the dollar. So it's a local number, or is it U.S.?
We recruit companies within 495, so it's a local. It's a greater Boston number.
So, go ahead.
I was going to say, if you compare it to the national number is more like 18 cents. But the national number is done with census data. And census data is not always as accurate as it can be, because you're asking an employee to remember what they made. Did they get a bonus?
But the point, Kim, is that on the national level, the wage gap is smaller.
Well, we don't think it's smaller. We just think the data is inaccurate, because ours comes right off the payroll system.
Well, here's what I think, Kim Borman. I think Boston could do better. And if we are the Athens of America, the enlightened ones, why aren't we doing better?
Because it's a hard, hard problem to solve. And, you know, again, 30 cents is quite a bit. We're not happy that it didn't change from 2019. One thing we did see was that there was a lot of economists, labor economists in particular, last fall when we were analyzing our data, said, we're going to see a an artificial narrowing of the wage gap, because we're going to have lost so many people, especially women, from the lower end of the salary ladder. And you can't close that. I mean, the gap will close artificially, because the average will be so off.
Right.
We did not see that. We actually saw that our employers kept their workforce intact. In fact, and this is pre-inflation, they increased salaries across the board by 12%.
Okay.
But,
Kim, go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, we don't think there were necessarily promotions going on, but that could be... Oh. Companies are trying to figure out how to survive.
It's a story on the Bloomberg Terminal getting lots of attention. CVS Rite Aid rationing Plan B pills. Cynthia Kuntz, our guest. There are Plan B pills that are being rationed. Then there are the so-called abortion pills, and apparently a series of pills, and those are not over-the-counter. So first, set us straight on what exactly we're talking about here.
Yeah, well, the rationing pertains to the emergency contraceptive. So it's a contraceptive pill. It's called Plan B. It's taken within 3 days of an incidence of unprotected sex, or if contraception fails, another method of contraception fails. And it is not an abortion pill, although sometimes it gets dragged into the conversation about abortion, but that's not an accurate portrayal of it, at least medically speaking. And so that is the medication that there's been a bit of a run on it, and people are going out trying to buy it in bulk now out of fear that they won't be able to access abortion, where they'd end up in a situation where they would need an abortion. And so this is entirely separate from actual abortion and the abortion pill. But I think there's a lot of confusion out there. I think a lot of people confuse Plan B and emergency contraception with the abortion pill, which is actually given to someone when they are pregnant and terminating a pregnancy.
And the abortion pill, you need a prescription. For the other, for the Plan B pill, you do not, correct?
Yes. And the abortion pill is very unique. The FDA has a lot of restrictions on its access. It dates back to when it was first approved. And there was a perception that it was a much more dangerous drug than it's turned out to be, based on how studies of it have shown it's held up through the years. It's just not as risky as people initially thought. But the FDA has a lot of safeguards on the abortion pill, and states have added their own state-level bans on administration of the abortion pill. So it's not as straightforward to get as any other drug in America. It's actually quite hard to get your hands on. You have to go to a certified prescriber, for example, which is quite unique. And so there are reasons why
what does
the
that
abortion
mean?
Pill.
What is that?
So it means that someone who wants to actually prescribe the abortion pill, whereas your GP could, generally speaking, prescribe most drugs, particularly something like this that might fall under, you know, primary care.
Sure.
They cannot prescribe this drug unless they're on a list of certified prescribers. And there's been a lot of fights within the sort of from the abortion community about this, because the thinking being is people don't want to be on a list where they're identified as an abortion provider, because there's been so much violence against abortion providers and clinics through the years. So there's been reluctance from the medical community to embrace this drug quite like they would, you know, something else. Like,
well, who's
the
keeper? Who's the keeper of the list or making this rule? I mean, where's it coming from?
The decision to have it done this way was from the FDA. The list itself would be either the company that has access to the pill or the FDA. But the fear has been, and the reason this has always been sort of a deterrent for doctors, has been that doctors themselves are concerned that this pill, being on this list might open them up to some sort of, you know, potential like risk that they wouldn't necessarily have if they could just prescribe this drug like they could any other drug.
So, Cynthia, our reporting says that each of these pharmacy chains has an ample supply of Plan B and Aftera, both online and in the store. So I guess this is precautionary for them. I'm interested in what might happen online because apparently, again, according to our reporting, Fiona Rutherford and Allison Nicole Smith sharing a byline here, you can get these online. I would imagine the rationing pertains to online. But I'm wondering how, and maybe we haven't gone there yet, but when a push comes to shove, these states that do outlaw the procedure, will they be surveilling? Will they be watching to see who might order these online from a state that would have them? And is that a concern?
So right now, it doesn't appear as though there's litigation that's necessarily going to create problems for access to contraceptives, okay? That's the status quo right at this moment.
Okay.
But I think there's a possibility, a highly likely possibility that could change. I think, you know, once upon a time, people would say it's not possible that Roe would get overturned, but here we are. So obviously, as these things sort of get wind and pick up and lawsuits work their way through the courts, realities shift. So there's a lot of fear, I think, right now that contraception is potentially the next target. And Plan B gets swept up the most of any contraceptive method, I would say, in this conversation, because it has been wrongfully described as an abortion treatment where it is not. Okay. And so, yes, I think that's why people are buying it right now. But I think the reality is there isn't necessarily a clear-cut legal pathway right now that would make it such that this would not be available over the counter. But I think people are just trying to protect themselves because it's clear that people's access to healthcare is being taken away here.
Tom and Joe, I have a great story for anyone who loves to scuba dive and anyone who's a World War II history buff. Some explorers, deep sea explorers, have found a World War II Navy destroyer, and it is the deepest shipwreck ever discovered. Have you heard about this today?
No.
Where?
How deep?
In the Philippines, okay? Mm-hmm. It is a depth of 22,916 feet, so they obviously needed some very high-tech marine robotics to find it. I believe that's more than 2 miles deep.
Yeah, I was about to grab my wetsuit, but I think I am not qualified to dive
that deep.
Janet,
you're a diver, and I'm a diver.
Diving.
Have you ever done a wreck dive that's pretty deep?
I have. Not that deep. 100 feet, 120 feet. Yeah.
Yeah. I did a 122, and it was really hard to see very much, but it was still very fun.
Wait a minute. So you two did 120 feet. We're talking 22,000 feet?
Yeah. Yeah. No, this is when you need a nice...
Bit of a difference.
Yes.
Yeah, this is a U.S.
Don't you
Navy...
need, like, a container?
Yeah. And some people do that.
Oh, yeah. You would need...
James Cameron, you need a...
Yeah, a lot of cameras and
a lot of...
Like, basically a miniature submarine. But this was a U.S. Navy destroyer that engaged a superior Japanese fleet in the largest sea battle of World War II in the Philippines.
Wow.
And it's the USS Samuel B. Roberts, popularly known as the Sammy B., a ship they've been looking for.
Wow.
And it was identified, broken into two pieces on a slope at this depth of 20.
So I was just saying James Cameron is probably racing over there now. That's what I was thinking.
It is. It's a movie. It's a movie to be made.
Yeah, it really is. And I can tell our producer's into this because he's typed into our chat Tupperware when I said container. So.
I was a certified scuba diver when I was in my 20s, but it was all about pretty shells.
Really? Oh, yeah. I'm the only one here who hasn't scuba dived.
Really? Oh, okay.
I snorkeled off of Cape Cod. Does that count at all?
It faded over time.
All right. Very good story, and thank you very much for
all that. Thanks to Pete, our producer, for bringing it to my attention.
Thank you, Pete. Thank you very much.
He must be exhausted. You know what I mean? You got to get that whole story for her. Right. I know.
Then he make fun of it.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. All right, listen. The Mass High Tech Council is holding a series of virtual summits. Now, this is designed to look into the future of technology here in the Commonwealth. The latest event focused on one of the biggest concerns shared by all CEOs across all sectors. Bloomberg's Janet Wu, a scuba diver herself, has joined us in the 106.1 studios with those details. Janet.
This is the escalation of cyber attacks. They're costly and they're damaging on so many levels. And the problem has only worsened since Russia's invasion of Ukraine. If you are a regular listener to this show, you know that Boston has become a hub for cybersecurity. And it starts with the research happening here. The Mass High Tech Council event opened with Mark Bristow of MITRE. That's a nonprofit corporation based here in Massachusetts that supports federal funding into the research of aviation, defense, homeland, and cybersecurity.
Cyberspace is now contested space. This wasn't always true. We used to live in a world where the internet was this great new thing. It was enabling all these great business outcomes, and it was creating all these new and wonderful opportunities, the application of the internet to all the things in our business world. But it also came with some drawbacks. And we're now starting to see organizations using capabilities against cyberspace to hold us at risk. Ukraine being the first country to have the distinction of having a cyber effects operation actually impact its domestic critical infrastructure back in 2015 when the Russians went after the Ukrainian electric power system and shut down power in Ukraine. That was the first time we saw a cyber attack actually impacting civilian infrastructure. Even if we're not necessarily the target, our infrastructure has been impacted. We've seen, read the news, right? Ransomware is a scourge that's impacting lots of different organizations around the globe. We've seen cyber attacks against critical infrastructure in foreign space. We've seen cyber miscreants happen, things like the Oldsmar Water incident going after critical infrastructure domestically. There's lots and lots of case studies and examples of cyber having impact into our infrastructure. And these are the things that we all rely on every day as foundational assumptions that are going to work, that ultimately enable us to do whatever it is we do for society. We need to start talking about resiliency. Resiliency is really all about not defending all the things all the time. It's about changing our paradigm and our planning constructs so that when things go awry due to man-made non-kinetic incidents, such as cyber attacks, we can still deliver our service. We can still deliver healthcare to the public. We can still, at a minimum, safely shut down our systems. We can still do our billing. Maybe we got to go back to manual. Maybe we have a backup computer that makes it happen. What steps do we need to take to prepare for this new reality? Cyber is hard to do. It's really hard to do at scale. And quite frankly, it's not the core expertise of most of our organizations. How are we going to increase that resiliency? That comes from everything from how do we change the paradigm so that our adversaries don't want to come after us? How do we defend ourselves? And how do we blunt the impact of those cyber attacks? You know, a lot of organizations are very, very focused on, we got to stop all the attacks, right? We got to stop all the intrusions. I'm here to tell you, that's not the right answer. It's not how do you stop everything. It's how do you continue to achieve your goals while denying the adversary theirs. You don't have to stop the activity. You just have to make it unimportant to you, especially with the small businesses, right? How do we build solutions that will scale to defeat or at least minimize the impact on a small business from Russian state actors going after satellite communications providers in space that ultimately impact the local gas pump's ability to get payment for their service? Those are the key challenges that we have as a community, and we have no choice but to rise to them, because this problem is simply growing. It's growing in its ability to impact, and a lot of the answers aren't cyber answers. there are resiliency and business planning answers. Cyber is contested space, and the homeland is no longer the sanctuary it once was.
I wanted to provide that overview because he was addressing CEOs of all size companies on what they need to think about. As you heard, he is warning companies to not try and stop all the attacks, which is fast becoming futile, but to build resiliency in recovering from attacks in order to keep business continuity. As cyber attacks increase, oftentimes businesses have been ashamed to admit they've been breached, and they are often embarrassed to reveal they've been forced to pay ransoms, and they also don't reveal how much they've paid. The cost to reputation can sometimes be worse than the actual financial hit. Now, at this event, the CEO of one of the largest companies in Massachusetts stepped up to talk about the breach at his company. UKG is co-headquartered in Lowell, the result of a merger of Kronos and Ultimate Software. The multinational company provides workforce and HR management services. It has over 13,000 employees and an annual revenue of over $3.25 billion. In December, 6 months ago, it disclosed a ransomware attack that affected many of its biggest customers. We are talking about Marriott International, PepsiCo, Tesla, Whole Foods, Yamaha, even the New York Metropolitan Transit Authority. Speaking to fellow Massachusetts CEOs, UKG Chairman and CEO Aaron Ain revealed what he learned from being attacked.
What I learned is I don't assume anything anymore about this. I've become very untrusting in an environment that requires the highest level of trust. I question everything and I doubt everything. And, you know, we had all the certifications. We were all, you know, gold stamped and all that, but it wasn't good enough. And so, look, I think CEOs and leaders need to step up here and do what needs to be done. And they have to make their organizations uncomfortable. And they have to make their customers uncomfortable who interact with our systems, if your systems touch, you know, your customers. And I'm prepared to do that, and we explain that now. We can't take shortcuts anymore, and it goes across the whole organization, and we can't let the moments, the pleading moments of I'm too busy or do we really have to do this. For us, there's no middle ground anymore. It's, you know, all in all the time with this and across the whole organization, including, again, our customers. And some customers have been a little frustrated with some of the changes we made, you know, the majority who weren't impacted, because we made all the changes, not just to the system where the 2,000 customers were impacted, but for all of our systems where the other 68,000 customers who weren't impacted. And some of them don't understand it, so we have to clearly explain it to them. But once we do, they get it. I had a Fortune 25 company when we explained how the bad guys got in, what the access vector was. They said, oh my gosh, we use that third party tool the same way you use it. So we all can learn from this.
You heard there, UKG had 2,000 of their customers affected. UKG is a private company owned in part by the Blackstone Group, so many details were never publicly discussed. But you could hear from his tone, it was costly and wrenching for him. Now, coming up tomorrow, you will hear how he got the company back online, some of the steps they took. Plus, you'll hear from cyber consultants at McKinsey, how they advise companies, and also one of the most prominent cybersecurity CEOs who is often a guest on our show, Corey Thomas of Rapid7. You'll hear how he is also helping to shore up cybersecurity for companies in Massachusetts and beyond.
Well, Janet, you certainly continue the reporting on this. Really is a cybersecurity hub here in Boston.
Yeah, it's more and more companies, and not only they don't just start here, but as we've seen and we've reported here, there are many companies that are starting overseas. In the last month, we've interviewed new companies from Israel and Ireland, if you recall, that started there but come here to scale because we have the network, we have the brain power, we have the graduates, and also we are geographically ideal because they are servicing the Middle East, Europe, as well as the West Coast and the East Coast. So they want to be in Boston for that reason.
Another headline of the Bloomberg Terminal, certainly that was impacting the markets today. U.S. consumer confidence hit 16-month low on drag from inflation. Conference board index sags to the lowest since February of 21. Expectation index plummets to worst in nearly a decade. Let's bring in Bloomberg reporter Olivia Rockman, who covers the U.S. economy for Bloomberg. Olivia, I suppose not overly surprising, but there is one thing that I found in your story today, in the terminal, that was a little bit surprising to me. Despite these low numbers on consumer confidence, you write that buying plans for like homes, cars, and appliances are holding up.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that just speaks to, you know, the consumer behavior that we've seen through so much of the pandemic that, you know, we saw in this report that vacation plans are declining. But at the same time, people just won't stop buying these big ticket items like cars and homes. And so it's really a continuation of what we saw beginning in 2020, and we haven't really seen that rotation away from goods and towards services yet.
So, Olivia, if we can take Joe's question as one of the, you know, unexpected turns in this, were there others? Did you see things you didn't expect?
I think it was more that we saw things that we hadn't been seeing yet that finally started to show up. So one example is, nearly 30% of the respondents to this survey expect business conditions to worsen later this year. And that's the largest percentage since 2009, which was, of course, the height of the financial crisis. And so the reality of sort of where the economy is headed is starting to settle in for folks. And it hadn't in the prior report.
Yeah, to just to drill down a little deeper on that, Olivia Rockman's our guest, Bloomberg reporter, you say expectations have now fallen well below a reading of 80, suggesting weaker growth in the second half of 2022, as well as a growing risk of recession by year end. And this all comes as just as a result of a survey, correct?
That's correct. This is from the Conference Board, and they survey consumers about sort of how they view the state of the U.S. economy, and it's based on an index that we get every single month.
Yeah. And did we have analysts kind of predicting what would happen? Did this, how did that go? How did that square what people thought, the experts thought?
Analysts had called for the number to decline from May to, you know, about 100, which is an index figure, and it did fall more than they had expected, which again sort of points to this idea that consumers are increasingly getting concerned about what's to come as the Fed raises rates. Mm-hmm.
But, Olivia, I guess my question is, you know, what they're concerned about and what they're saying in this confidence and what they're doing doesn't necessarily match up. Is that fair to say?
That's correct. So it's fair to say that consumers, the ones that at least, you know, can afford to make these purchases are still heading toward, you know, homes and cars. But that said, this drop in vacation plans, we saw especially a big drop in plans for taking road trips, and that may correspond with rising gas prices. And so it seems like consumers are in some ways reacting to higher prices, but other ways they aren't.
Well, can we pick up socioeconomic trends from this? In other words, what are the cohorts? What are the people, who are they that are still buying these big items? Who are they that are delaying vacation plans? Are we seeing any kind of a difference, or is this across the board?
The trends are in this report are pretty consistent across age groups. Mm-hmm. Consumer confidence, for example, sunk last month for all age groups. And what, so, oh, go ahead.
What about socioeconomic? I suppose that does in some ways track with age group.
Yeah, it of course does. And, you know, we are hearing at least anecdotally that it is the folks on the lower income spectrum that are going to be the most hit by food and gas and then are going to be quicker to pull back on discretionary spending.
Mm-hmm. I guess my question has to do with, you know, a report like this and its historic context. I mean, does it match up, Olivia, with normal, you know, surveys by the Conference Board? I mean, in other words, when we see this incongruity where people are buying and yet they're saying everything's terrible, I mean, is that what normally happens and people hold on to the hope until they actually go off the cliff?
It isn't, and that's what's so unique about this pandemic is that, you know, you see stock prices sinking, you see inflation off the charts, and yet this, you know, consumer behavior to spend on goods just continues to be strong. And it's been the same in the PCE report, which is a government report separate from this one. And so the big question for economists is, like, when do consumers stop buying stuff? And we haven't had the answer yet.
Yeah, it's so interesting.
Right. When does it match up?
Well,
right.
We had Rich Miller on. He writes from D.C., and I'll tell you one of the most enlightening things he said. He keeps track sort of the aggregate numbers and savings accounts and so forth. And he told us a week or two ago, these were still strong. Right. And I've asked people since then, economists included, Olivia, when does the money run out? So that's now at your, I lay this at your feet. When does the money run out?
So economists, you know, a couple of months ago had been predicting that by now, especially for the lower income bracket, excess savings would have run out. But, you know, this data is suggesting that at least people have some savings to spend on discretionary items.
Let's get to this now. We're going to have a discussion about restaurants. But in particular, we're going to start with a tale out of Lexington, where the health inspector or the public health director was notified that there were French fries on the floor of a pasta restaurant. So what's wrong with this picture? Let's bring in Joanne Bellinger. She is the public health director in that town. And Joanne, we had a quick discussion last night, so you filled me in on some of the details. But why don't you take our audience through this? This discovery of French fries on the floor of, and the Globe has identified this restaurant as Bertucci's. So that's a well-known place. Take us through what happened.
Well, during a... First of all, thank you for having me. Sure. I appreciate the time on your show. But what happened was during a routine inspection, when there was other issues noted in the inspection at the time, there was French fries noted on the floor, which is not in the approved menu for that establishment. Mm. So it brought up the question as to how and why they were here on the floor, and that eventually led to finding out that there was other businesses operating, or Bertucci's was operating other businesses out of that particular brick-and-mortar restaurant that we knew nothing about and that weren't permitted.
Okay. All right. So what's wrong with that? I mean, one of our guests coming up is Bob Luz, the president of the Massachusetts Restaurant Association. He's going to say, you know, so what? It's all food. Everything's fine here.
Yeah, I know. I saw that comment, too. And, you know, basically in the public health world, there's a lot more to it than just that. I mean, our job is to protect the public's health, to make sure that restaurants are abiding by the food code and sanitary conditions and things of that nature. And food is not necessarily all equal, if you will. So there are certain foods that require certain temperature in terms of preparing, certain types of equipment in terms of storage, you know, when we're talking about sushi versus pizza, things like that. So when a particular restaurant comes before us for licensing, those are the questions that we ask. What are you preparing? Mm-hmm. What is your menu going to be? So that we can look at the storage, the equipment, the refrigeration, the cooking, the grease production, all of that in terms of that particular business. And when they go beyond or expand beyond what has been approved, then they're supposed to come to us, come back for changes. And in some instances, they may or may not be able to do it based on maybe the physical setup of the establishment. So all foods are not actually equal. And again, especially with allergies and allergens and, you know, things like that in terms of the actual food itself. Okay.
Joanne Bellinger is with us, Director of Public Health in Lexington, talking about these ghost kitchens, the discovery in the preparation room, the cooking room, if you will, the back room of Bertucci's there. Joanne, I'm curious, how many ghost kitchens or how many different operations did you finally uncover in Bertucci's, and what did they produce? Are we talking two or three or four? What give us the details.
Well, there was, you know, approximately, you know, three. We did find that there was I believe it was a cookie company. It was another burger type of establishment. I believe it may have been some kind of a wings establishment as well.
So it's three. So in people who order these, that we got to remember, they order them on these delivery services. So they don't they don't understand, they don't realize this is coming from the same place they may have gone to sit down and have a meal at Bertucci's.
Correct. Yes. So, and that's where part of the problem arises, you know, at least for us, in terms of the protection of the public health, is that people don't understand or know where their food is coming from. They go on these sites and they look for something local. They find an address for whatever particular food item that they're looking at, for a street that they know about, an address that sounds legit. What they don't know, because they don't go to pick it up, is where it actually is being produced. So they're assuming it is its own store and not a completely different restaurant that's just expanding their menu and operating under a completely different business name.
Well, I think, you know, I'll venture to say that ghost kitchens aren't going anywhere. They're probably not going away. So what does Joanne Ballinger think should happen here?
Oh, well, if it's not only up to me, but I think there's most likely a way to work with the industry and try to figure out the best way to again protect the public health, which is our business. We don't go into a restaurant or any kind of an establishment with the mindset of, you know, we're going to shut you down or we're going to find complaints or violations. We try to also keep the restaurants and the business and the food industry in business,
right,
by making sure that they are safe and sanitary and following, the correct laws that are in place.
Right. So what do you want here? What do you want to have happen?
Well, you know, I wish I had the universal answer to that. And that's where we're all trying to work together and figure out the best way to go forward with this. The problem right now is, individual cities and towns are kind of handling it as they come across it. Universally, I don't know that any city or town is having restaurants reach out to them and go, hey, guess what? We're going to be operating under this license and this name. A lot of it is being discovered. So until and unless someone goes in and sees a sign or sees a packaging from not what the brick and mortar is supposed to be during a routine inspection, we don't know what's happening. I think if the industry could be maybe a little forthcoming and we could try to work together, maybe there isn't a way to do it. I don't have that answer.
Well, you know, Joanne,
we're trying.
Yeah, the more I think about it, I mean, when your folks go in, maybe one of the questions that gets on the list now is, what am I seeing here? Is this just, for instance, Bertucci's, or is this the cookie company too? And if it's the cookie company, show me the cookie makers. I also understand, I want people to get a sense of this. You told me in our earlier conversation, I said, well, is this the only place in Lexington? Because I know there are many restaurants in Lexington. And you said, well, it's the one we discovered. But you told me this is happening everywhere. And I believe part of that, your understanding, comes through conversations with your counterparts in other communities, no?
It is. In the article, obviously, there's a couple different perspectives of what's happening in different communities. And I've talked to other colleagues. And in most cases, they didn't know anything about it and may have, done a Google search and said, oh, my God, we have it in our Bertucci's, or we have it in our, XYZ.
Let me just tell you, let me share this with you, Joanne. We've had Robert Earl on. He's the company's Earl Enterprises in Florida. He owns Bertucci's, and he talks proudly about these ghost kitchens. But I'm thinking about this. If they're producing more volume than they have on their license, that's got to be a violation right away, no?
Well, yes, potentially. One of the things that we do look at is the number of meals served. It makes a big difference in the size of the facility, in their storage capacity, in their cooking equipment and things. How much can they produce? And if they are saying, one entity, I can produce this, and that's what we permit on, and then there's three other entities in there, so they're tripling their production. It could cause issues with the septic or the sewage or the grease trap overflowing. It could produce more trash, more rodents, yeah. more, you know, and that in and of itself is a problem.
Joanne Bellinger is the director of public health in Lexington. Joanne, let me ask you this. So would you mm-hmm. knowingly order from a ghost kitchen?
Knowingly?
Hmm. Hello? Yeah.
In other
Good
words,
question.
You may not know, right? You,
right. I guess that's the thing. You don't know. And that's the problem with the consumer is that they don't realize that the burger that they're getting is coming from the sushi store.
Joanne, we're almost out of time here. Has anybody gotten sick as a result of this in Lexington? I mean, do you have, you know, actual firsthand, if you will, evidence that this is a problem?
So in terms of foodborne illness, which is a very tricky thing to trace back, you know, if you've ever had a stomach ache after going out to eat, you know, you just chalk it up to, you know, something went wrong.
Right.
We don't get a lot of calls like that unless someone goes to the doctor and actually has a diagnosis, and then we can trace it back. So it's
tricky.
First of all, it's very tricky to do that investigation. And then if we're looking, and I think, you know, it was summed up in the article pretty good, if we're looking for a hamburger or a beef product, we're not going to be looking at the sushi place.
Our next guest is a regular visitor to Bloomberg Bay State Business. Sad to say, you know, we may not be hearing from him, very much after this, because Bob Luz is president of the Massachusetts Restaurant Association. He's retiring on June 30th, that being Thursday, and tomorrow and today will be, being Tuesday. He's down to his final 48 hours. Of course, the Massachusetts Restaurant Association is a West Borough-based trade group, has about 1,800 members. Including some 1,400 restaurant companies, as well as a $2 million budget and 8 staffers, looking at an article written by John Chesto announcing that Luz would be retiring. Bob, thanks so much for joining us today. And we do want to talk about, you know, umbrella drinks by the pool, which I'm sure are, you know, in your future here. But before we get to your retirement, we just had a whole segment with the director of public health there in Lexington, very concerned about the issue of ghost kitchens and suggesting that there's a real public health concern with all these ghost kitchens. You say what?
There is zero concern with that, like zero. This is a story that I can't believe is even surfacing, to be quite honest with you, Joe. And thank you and Tom for having me on. I greatly appreciate it. But look, a health inspection is a health inspection, and the food code is the food code. It doesn't matter when a health inspector comes through the back door. Chicken is chicken, whether it's going on Bob Burger's restaurant or Ann's Chicken restaurant. They're both going out the door. They're both held in the same refrigerator. They're both prepared the same way. The standard is the same. And so this is zero issue, and the city of Boston flat out came out and said that and agreed with me in the article in the Globe on Sunday. So,
what about, like, say, food allergies? As one inspector raised the question that, you know, perhaps you're mixing in peanuts in one of these ghost kitchens, and you're not, you know, but when other times you're ordering from Bertucci's, there's no worry about peanuts. And what about that?
Again, every restaurant has to hold the same standard for allergens, no matter what they serve. It has no difference. It's as simple as this. Think about this: when you go to a restaurant, they serve specials. The health inspector doesn't know what those specials are. If a restaurant owner says, geez, swordfish came in at a nice price today, swordfish, I'll run swordfish, I'll put this sauce on it. Mm-hmm. You know, the health inspector doesn't know that, right? So it's as simple as that. We have to hold the food code is the food code, no matter what it's served, when it's served, how it's served. It's the same thing for the four walls.
Yeah. Bob Luz is with us. Bob, good to have you here. So let's go to the Lexington example. It was a Bertucci's. She said there was a cookie cook company making cookies back there. There was, what else was it, Joe?
A French fry on the floor.
Yeah, there's a French fry, but there were three different operations. So food is food, but there are big differences. And she points out, for instance, if you're making pizza in the back shop, you're handing... You're packing up sushi to head out the door. That's going to mean two different, refrigeration standards. And my question. Well, hold on.
No,
My question to you is, couldn't these ghost kitchens kind of get lost in the inspection? Like, you know, you don't see those elements out when you're there for the inspection. Isn't it better for them just to know what you're doing back there?
Well, first of all, and again, both myself and Robert Earl, who's the CEO of Bertucci's and several other brands, said exactly the same thing. The easiest thing, if there's a concern, when the inspector comes in, all they have to say is, excuse me, are you running any other menus out of this restaurant?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
All of a sudden, we all know. So but the food standard is the same when it comes through the back door. Mm-hmm. It does not matter. Mm-hmm. It does not matter. The food code is the food code. No matter what you work, it's the four walls that the food code is enforced in.
Mm-hmm.
And so, Tom, there are no different standards for sushi, you know, sushi going out the door versus fish going on a grill. It's the same standard.
But would you think that, with all these ghost kitchens, that perhaps tracking a food-borne illness would be more difficult for an inspector who doesn't know what other food you're serving there?
Absolutely not.
At least absolutely. You're consistent.
You want to think about that?
No, absolutely no. Not.
I mean, it really is. I mean, and again, the city of Boston, which I think is a very focused city in terms of holding standards and inspectional services, the city of Boston came out and agreed wholeheartedly with what we said. They're like, look, this is, you know, the food code's the food code, the inspection's the inspection. Well,
yeah.
It doesn't, and literally, it's as simple as the one question: do you run any other menus out of here?
Right. Well, yeah, look, you know, hold on a second. So this, Bob, this goes to the question of credibility and honesty. So, if you have a menu, you have daily specials. Sometimes you post the daily specials, by the way. But if you have a totally different operation, are they always going to be honest with you about that? Because if you do cookies and not pizza in the back room, you're going to need different standards, and that's going to cost them money. And wouldn't some, not all, operators be inclined to keep that from the inspector?
No, absolutely not. Look, again,
you know, Bob, you could agree a little bit once in a while. It wouldn't kill you.
Tom. This is as simple as the food product comes back through the back door. It doesn't matter whether it's going out from Burton's Grill or Chili's or Bertucci's or Joe's American Bar and Grill or Davio. It's all the same standard.
Okay.
And again, there's a question of, I don't know there's a second menu.
But restaurants should disclose this information to inspectors, correct? The Bertucci should say, look, we've got six other online places operating out of here, correct?
It's important, Joe, to remember, these operators aren't hiding this from inspectors. What they're doing is they're saying, okay, our business is Bertucci's, but we're doing a second concept out of the kitchen that's delivery only, okay? And so because they don't want to confuse the customer walking through the door. And so, you know, it's not a bait switch type of thing.
No,
it's simply trying to maximize the kitchen because sales are so far off. And again, the food standard is the same no matter what. So the answer is no.
Bob, I don't think we're that far apart here. Wouldn't you agree? I mean, sort of get to Joe's point. I mean, if there should be some kind of disclosure, and you've already agreed to that, shouldn't we be able to say to these establishments that it has to be disclosed on an application or a license? That's all. I mean, is there a problem with that? You know, I'm making four different things here. It is.
No one's opposed to that.
So what's the argument? That. So what is the problem then? This is all the health inspector we talked
about. The argument is a couple of health boards have brought this up, whereas most of them have said it's not an issue. So, but, you know, again, the media sort of grabbed onto it and made it an issue, but it's not. Food safety is food safety no matter where you serve it.
But Bob, would you agree? But as somebody who is very proud of his industry and proud of how safe it is, would you agree that the online business that, you know, is not as a public a business could possibly create a problem, where I guess there was an example of a Thai restaurant in Needham that they shut down and then they just started operating online. So,
So let's go to that example. That's a great example, Joe. I'm glad you brought it up. That's just wrong. So the reality is that restaurant can't, and so they should be shut down.
Okay.
They, you know, if they're shut down by inspectional services or the health board for that reason, they can't open as another restaurant. It's illegal. So that in that case, they should be shut down. Absolutely.
But, okay.
But they did. They did open.
But they got caught. Look, there's always a bad apple out there, but we have really good standards where people go out and make sure that they find those things. You don't govern to the worst possible person in the worst possible business. You govern for the safety of all. And in that case, if someone's doing something wrong, then we'll turn them in, never mind the Board of Health.
Okay. Now, I understand what you're saying, Bob. So, but one more example, then we'll get on to some other things. But we've, in fact, our own Ann Mastu here reported on Ghost Kitchen. It was operating out of a trailer, so there was really no established bricks and mortar attached to the operation, so nobody knew about it. Now, I know you're going to say, yeah, we should, but how do we find out about it? It's a separate question, I agree.
Yeah, no. So that is a separate issue. And again, that type of establishment is called Reef Kitchen.
And that's happening.
They have to be inspected by the city in which they're performing in or doing business in. They have to be inspected. Once they're inspected and they're approved, then they can do business.
But how do you know they're there?
Those restaurants, those locations have to apply to the city that they operate in. Mm-hmm. They can't just show up.
Wow.
So they're licensed in the city that they operate in. But you don't know that you can't pull up to the trailer and get a to-go order.
We're talking with Bob Luz. He is the president of the Massachusetts Restaurant Association. All right, Bob, let's move out to the 10-mile view. Tell us about, you represent some 1,400 different restaurants. What is the status of the industry today? We've heard that a lot of restaurants have come back very strong, others have not. But what's the status of the Massachusetts restaurant industry today?
Yeah, so we're still in the needs improvement stage. We're still trying to get our feet back on firm ground. As well has been, talked about before, and we've talked about it here. 34 restaurants never came back from the original shutdown. We're still trying to get those restaurants that have survived back up on their feet. Two-thirds of the restaurants that applied for the Restaurant Revitalization Fund, which was the federal government's bailout of the restaurant industry, never received the money that they were promised because it ran out of money. So those restaurants are really suffering. And it's also a case of if I got it, and you didn't across the street, Tom, then I'm working at a different standard than you're working at. And so that's a little bit difficult in the industry. So the restaurant industry in general in Massachusetts is improving. Everybody sees restaurants busy on Friday and Saturday nights, but right now it's a Tuesday, and I'm in a restaurant out in Shrewsbury, and there's 12 people in the entire restaurant.
Yeah, but it's not even dinner time. You're there for the blue-haired specials, correct?
Well, it's 4:45. I mean, I'm not here for a blue-haired special, Tom, but, it's 4:45.
Okay, no, you're right.
Let
me ask you, I know we've said this before, but we consider this, at least in your official capacity, we want you back here, as a kind of an exit interview. I mean, the number of restaurants we lost in the pandemic, truly sort of breathtaking, and I do feel for those people who lost their operation, lost their livelihood. But there is something Darwinian about the free market. And wasn't this in some ways a healthy shakeout? What I'm asking you, didn't we have too many restaurants before the pandemic?
We might have been on too good of a swing there. I mean, one could make that argument. So, Massachusetts, tiny state, we have the 10th highest food and beverage sales in the United States. So, Massachusetts, our residents and our tourists and our guests that come to the state appreciate great hospitality. Mm-hmm. They go out to eat in restaurants, and the numbers proved it out. So supply and demand, you can argue maybe, Tom, that there were too many restaurants. I'd argue we're probably just about right. And, you know, it's unfortunately taken a big hit.
Mm-hmm. Bob Lutz is our guest, President and Chief Executive Officer of Massachusetts Restaurant Association, and he's down to about 48 hours. His time is dwindling here. Bob, what's left undone on your desk? What do you wish you perhaps had another year or two to accomplish?
You know, I'd rather leave knowing that the industry was 100% back and operating at full capacity, but. You know, that's not going to be the case for some time. But I'm comfortable that I'm leaving at the right time. I know, you know, people have said to me, you wish you retired in March of 2020. And the answer is absolutely not. I wouldn't have wanted to have been anywhere other than working with the administration of Governor Baker and Lieutenant Governor Polito and trying to, and I got to say, the administration and the legislature of Massachusetts was very, very supportive of small business and restaurants, and understanding that 10% of the workforce works inside of a restaurant in Massachusetts. And so many first-time jobs and good-paying jobs and careers come out of it. It has been my honor to work on that with those people, fighting for all those restaurateurs the last 2 years. I wouldn't have given it up for the whole world.
No.
So I can walk away now knowing that they're in a better place, but they still got a long ways to go.
Well said. Bob Luz is with us, head of the Restaurant Association here in the Commonwealth. In your tenure, Bob, what has changed on the restaurant scene in your territory for the better and for the worse?
Well, I mean, look, we were in the best of times before March of 2020. I mean, literally, the restaurant scene in Massachusetts was as hot as there was anywhere in the United States. We were known nationally as a leader, internationally as a leader. And we have so many James Beard winners, which is our, Oscars, mm-hmm. Emmy Award winners. Our chefs became celebrities. I mean, Tiffany Piazon from downtown Boston right now, she just mm-hmm. won a huge competition on TV within the last month or so. Mm-hmm. We are known for having just really tremendous restaurants. And that scene is going to come back. We need to get business travel back in here. We need to get people back to work in the big cities. That's really important because that's where a lot of these restaurants are. And so we need to really continue down the road there and get that back up. But, you know, those chefs elevated us on TV as an industry and really made this industry shine in the greater Boston area. Its shine will be back very, very soon.
Bob, what about inflation and food prices at this point? As we talk about rising food prices, and everybody's talking about that, and how hard it is for the consumer, in the face of a recession where we're, suggesting that perhaps people are going to start cutting back and cutting back at a time when restaurants, perhaps are getting a little bit more expensive. How concerned are you about this environment that is developing here?
Yeah, we're very concerned. I mean, look, the new pandemic for restaurants is inflation. The second pandemic is certainly the staff shortage in an industry that's very labor intensive. So, year over year restaurant spending, growth is slowing no matter what you say. I mean, the numbers bear it out right now. And, we've got to be very, very concerned about it. So, again, once we say restaurants are starting to recover, they have a whole new pandemic. Menu prices have gone up in the last year over 18%. We can't sustain that. Home prices, food at supermarkets is up 18%. Food at restaurants is up 12%. So they're doing their best to hold back on that increase through. We realize that our guests have got limits. And so it's going to be really critical that we get our hands around this and evolve as an industry as we go forward. That's going to be menu changes and business changes as we go forward.
Bob Luz is with us. We call this his exit interview. On Thursday, he steps away from his job as the head of this association. And you've always been a good conversation, Bob. I just wonder, hand in hand with this, the inflation, the price of things goes the staffing challenges. We remember during the deep deepest, darkest parts of the pandemic, people were saying, you know, this is really hard work, this restaurant work. And I know firsthand, it is. I know a lot of people listening know in their younger years, hard work. People saying, I'm going to go find something else to do. How do you keep the interest? And I'm sure it's one of the things you feel responsible for, the interest in this industry for young people coming up.
Yeah, I mean, first of all, this industry is incredible because you don't need to be Harvard educated to do really, really well in it, right? I mean, this is an industry where if you know how to treat people right and treat them with dignity and respect, you can grow from a dishwasher to a line cook to an executive chef to a restaurant owner. And I've seen it over and over again. I've seen people start as a dishwasher and end up in the boardroom of really huge publicly traded restaurant companies. And so we take pride in the fact that we offer opportunity for ownership in higher numbers to women, and more women and minorities than any other industry in America. And that is something that I'm extremely proud of, something that every restaurateur is extremely proud of. And that's going to continue. And the entrepreneurship and the philanthropic nature of our industry really unites communities across Massachusetts, from Pittsfield to Boston, from Newburyport to Provincetown, and everywhere in between. And you're going to see that going forward. And it's been my pride to work on behalf of the incredibly hardworking restaurant owners across Massachusetts for so long. And my successor, Steve Clark, who's been my right hand for the last 9 years, and was here 2 years before that. He's going to keep that going as we go forward.
You know, Bob, it's not really fair, but I'd love to hear you give a shout out to 5 or 6 or 7 or 8 or 9 restaurants out there that, our listeners would love to hear. You know, what does Bob love, president of the Massachusetts Restaurant Association? What restaurants does he love? Or does he really recommend geographically? Take a moment and perhaps, spread the love with what restaurants you really like.
I'm going to give you the same answer, Joe, that I've been given since I started this job. When people say, what's your favorite restaurant? Look, we have 1,400 members. They have 5,500 locations.
Yeah.
I have 1,400 favorite restaurants.
Really?
Across the state.
Yeah.
And each one of them is just special to me.
Where are you right now? Where's the restaurant? What restaurant?
I can factually answer to you that I am in Burton's in Shrewsbury, Massachusetts.
What are you having to eat there?
I just add a little cauliflower, and I'm having an adult beverage for myself.
An adult beverage and cauliflower. This guy knows how to have a good time.
And I got a very special guest with me that I got to get back to.
All right. Well, we're almost done here. I'm going to go at this another way. We don't want names, but can you name, in your tenure as the head of the Restaurant Association, the best meal you ever had? Can you describe it for us? We don't need where you ate it, just what you had.
Yeah. What's your favorite food?
I have 1,400 members that have 5,500 locations.
You know, my friend, you're off the clock in 2 days.
Yeah, come back on Friday and tell us.
But I'm a private citizen. You can ask me back, and I'll answer that.
So you're going to be consulting for a little bit, right?
I am. Well, I'm happy to help you as we go forward.
Well, I tell you what, you were one of the first of our guests, and it was always a good conversation, although, I will forget about the insults.
Yeah, he coined the phrase.
Tom Maroney, where fun goes to die.
Yeah, Tom Maroney, where fun goes to die. He's Bob Luz.
He's going to be on for 7 minutes, and now it's like 27 minutes.
All right. Well, listen, congratulations, pal. And we're delighted to enjoy your retirement and do come back and see us in your next life.
And enjoy that cauliflower.
Cauliflower.
Mm.
Yeah.
I don't know. I should try that. Cauliflower and scotch.
I didn't think I was going to get an answer, but then, he's got 1,400.
You can't even get a favorite meal out of the guy.
Yeah.
I mean, come on. At least, big steak.
Well, now he's got to, as of Friday, he's got to pay for his meals, right?
We'll leave that one alone.
We will? Okay. All right. I guess it must be time to talk about tomorrow, right? Okay, tomorrow. Let's see. We're going to be talking with Spencer Betts. Now, he's the chief financial officer at Bickling Financial Services in Lexington, Massachusetts. And I think this is an interesting topic. Hmm. It's a new report that's out. It's talking about people who are unretiring all of a sudden. Hmm. They decided to retire, and then this whole inflation basket of mess came our way, and now they're rethinking it. And I guess it covers all kinds of demographics.
Yeah. All right, Joe, thanks. Also, let's get this in before we have to go. Breaking across the Bloomberg terminal, Tesla lays off hundreds of autopilot employees in California. Tesla closes the San Mateo office. People familiar say, that's those folks we're quoting, who do not want to be named for, I suppose, obvious reasons. Straight ahead, of course, it's Sound On with Joe Matthew. Joe's going to bring the latest, the biggest political stories of the day. I'm Tom Maroney with Joe Shortsleeve. Kim Kerrigan off today, but I'm expecting her back tomorrow. In filling in ably on the news desk. And Janet, whoa, that's our team. This is Bloomberg.